This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And this week we're going to be doing things a little bit differently. I have been trying to get certain guests on as I plan to start wrapping up this show over the next few weeks. And I wanted to get this guest on in particular, so I taped my interview with Dr. Corey Edgar this week, and that will be in the second half of today's program. Dr. Edgar is an associate professor of orthopedic surgery. He's also the co-director for the Institute for Sports Medicine at the University of Connecticut, as well as being a team physician. Obviously, there's so much sideline coverage going on Saturdays that he couldn't be with us live, but I really wanted to chat with him about a couple of things, and the main thing was many people have asked me about their children and grandchildren and their activities when it comes to throwing. And he is truly an expert when it comes to the elbow and upper extremity and taking care of athletes. So I had a great conversation with him about that. And there's also, we hear so much about stem cells, we talk about biologics, we hear a lot of advertisements for it, and his research has been in orthopedics and the use of biologics. So I really wanted to hear from an expert to know what works and what doesn't work. And when you hear ads on the radio and on TV, what's true and what's not? And I learned quite a bit from the conversation with him. So we're specifically talking about these biologics in orthopedic surgery. So I think you'll all get something out of that. If you want to reach me, as always, I'm at info@alessimd.com. And I wanted to stress that even when this show does go off the air later this year, that email is always available to my listeners here. A little follow-up to last week. We had Dr. David Banik on, and we talked about West Nile virus and really the implications of this virus. If you'll recall, it's a mosquito-borne virus. It's been pretty rarely seen, but when it does cause illness, when it causes an infection, it could be severe. Some of the data that just came out is that over 770 people in 39 states have already been reported and documented to have West Nile virus this year alone. That's 40% more than last year. And the question is why? Why is that all of a sudden a problem? And it's primarily due to warmer temperatures, increased amounts of rain that we're seeing, and these climate changes are providing an environment where mosquitoes can prosper, and some of those are infected with West Nile virus. Some of the things you could do to prevent it. Obviously, we always hear about covering up when you're outside. If you're hiking, wear long pants, long sleeves. I have gone to using a new repellent with picardin, P-I-C-A-R-D-I-N. It doesn't smell like DEET. It doesn't feel real ooky and greasy. And I found it to be very effective if I'm out and about getting some exercise. I haven't had a problem. So you may want to look into getting that. One of the other things came up this week. I attended Grand Rounds in person this week at Hartford Hospital, and we had a wonderful speaker, and Dr. Mahari is his name. He's a neurologist, and he is in Texas. He is an American, went to school here, but he is of Ethiopian descent. And he talked a lot about putting together a stroke program for people in Ethiopia and now throughout Africa. And I sat there really thinking, and, you know, you sit there and it gets you thinking more and more about how it affects you. And I think of Haiti and saw the similarities where people don't have medications for those risk factors, you know, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. People are just trying to survive in these environments. And these diseases really don't have boundaries. I mean, really no disease does. And I felt it important to talk to, you know, at Grand Rounds, it's a great opportunity for more senior physicians like myself to be around younger physicians, residents, and trainees. And I felt it's important that we all understand as physicians that we have to understand that medicine is global and take that position and not be afraid to get out of our comfort area and go to other areas and find out what we can do to affect a change. And in the case of Dr. Mahari, I asked about USAID and its abrupt closure, and it's clearly having an effect. USAID was our principal way of funding global health and education projects. And as always, you know, the world is kind of a messed up place right now, and it's important that we work together as physicians. Unfortunately, he runs a conference every year and in Africa, and unfortunately, many physicians who are working here and have been working here for years are afraid to go back because they're afraid they won't be able to get back into the country despite having adequate papers and documentation, which brings me to the issue of visas. I heard the H-1B-1 visas now are going to require a $100,000 payment. Now, I've listened to Eric Semmel and really present an interesting argument. These H-1B-1 visas are primarily used for tech workers, and Apple and Meta bring people in to work here who are qualified, but they do it so that they could pay them less money and not hire American tech workers, which is wrong. But I don't think the $100,000 fee is going to make any difference to Apple or Meta. And the reason I bring this up is because many physicians come here primarily on J-1 visas, but some on H-1B-1 visas. Now, that's a different story because these physicians are required to go to rural areas to spend a certain amount of time there and giving back, paying taxes before they can move on and get a green card. So we want to be very careful here that we don't kind of bite our nose off to spite our face, to use a saying, and that we're not eliminating young physicians from coming to this country from other countries to provide care for Americans. So it's something we're going to want to keep an eye on as that process develops. One of the things I read about this week also is about credit scores and mental health. Now, you would think, well, everybody with a lot of money should be happy, right? But this was different. It took a different tact. I mean, your credit score is basically a score of your financial risk. It's based on your history of making payments, the amount you owe people or companies, the length of your credit history, your new credit, the mix of different types. There are a lot of factors that go into this, but it's a key factor if you want to buy something or you want to rent an apartment, if you want to buy a car or provide adequate housing for yourself or your family and purchase power. What they found is if they looked at the regional credit score, if looking at an area and looking at the credit score for that area, typically the lower the credit score, the higher the issues of mental health. But I think that that can be extended over to physical health, right? Because when you think about it, if you don't have adequate housing, if you don't have a vehicle in many places to get to health care, if you don't have a device, a tablet of some type or a phone or access to the internet, you really can't get a lot of health advice. So the goal is to keep people healthy. We have to look at it from a financial standpoint. And I was very happy to see that in this podcast and the article accompanying it, they held Connecticut out as being a model state. And the reason is because starting in July of 2023, we have a system of what we call baby bonds. Basically, these are trust funds for children born into families who are on Husky, and it's a bond for $3,200. That bond does not become accessible to the child until age 18, and from age 18 to 30, they can incrementally take some money out, only if they are using it for something that produces income, meaning buying a home, education, starting a business, even putting money into retirement. So it's a wealth-building plan. And what you'll find is that people who are able to build assets of some type will have better health. So we appreciate that on the back end of that investment. So I was happy to see that, and they are using that in a model as a model in other states, and I was happy to know that we've been doing it for 2 years already. So again, an interesting point about your income and building wealth and staying healthy. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back, and I'm going to talk about what we finally have, maybe finally, have resolved regarding what we're doing about vaccination as we come up on flu and COVID season. If you wish to reach out to me, you can get me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And following up from last week's discussion with Dr. Banik, at which time we were waiting for the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices to come out with some guidance from the CDC regarding who should be vaccinated. Now, this was a meeting that was supposed to take place in July so that we would have enough time to order, purchase, manufacture vaccines that are needed now. But he decided to fire the entire committee and bring in a group of people, many of them known to be against vaccines, to advise us on how we should be immunized. The other thing you need to know about another program called the Vaccines for Children program. I'm going to get to all of that. So the committee met this week, and the issues have been around the measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella vaccines, so chickenpox. And here has been the fear. The only thing, well, let's go back. Let's a little history, I think, is necessary here. There was a guy named Andrew Wakefield. He's a former British physician and actually described as a fraudster. He was taken off the medical register in England for serious professional misconduct. In 1998, he published an article falsely claiming that there was a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. That study was proven absolutely false, and he admitted to falsifying the data. That one article led to a decline in vaccination rates, increased in measles around the world, and many deaths. That's where this all started, 1998. Then we have a fellow by the name of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's out there fighting for environmental causes and joining arm in arm with liberal moms to go out, like Jenny McCarthy, to go out and sue the drug companies because they're causing autism. And what we're seeing now is that same RFK Jr. now kind of switching sides. He's now working with conservative moms. And this just goes to show you that it's health. It's not politics. But what he is now is in the middle of a concerted effort to really dismantle the premier health system in the world, the CDC. So this committee he's appointed hasn't met till now. He fired the head of the CDC that he appointed, who was a scientist. And now we sit with bated breath to hear what they have to say. And basically, this group has nothing to say. Here's where we are. Normally, the measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella vaccine is administered to children at age 12 months. They now recommend it not be given until 4 years. But if you split the vaccination, so you just give MMR and give varicella later, that would be allowed before age 4 years. That's where we are there. So essentially, we're back to square one, which is fine, because it allows people to make a choice and do what they want. The people who don't have a choice are people in the Vaccines for Children program. That is the program that is funded by Medicaid, and they can only follow the CDC guidance, which is no guidance right now. So things are good from that standpoint, the way I read it, but it's confusing. And the only way we're going to get around confusion is what we did this week here in Connecticut. We joined the Northeast Public Health Collaborative. That is a collaborative of public health experts from New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Maine. For some reason, Vermont and New Hampshire haven't jumped in yet. And I think there's a reason for that that we'll get to. But when we look at measles numbers, and I urge you, go to this. There's an excellent map at nbcnews.com/vaccine divide. And it looks at the percentages of vaccination. So for measles, to reach herd immunity for this one problem, we use measles because it is the most viral of them. If it's contacted on a surface, it'll be there for 2 or 3 days. So herd immunity, 95%. Gainesville City, Texas, if you'll remember, they're the people who had this outbreak in Texas last year, where three people died. Their rate was 77%. So the problem here is that since 2019, 77% of U.S. counties have seen a decline in vaccination rates. So I get onto this map, and I want to look at Connecticut. Hartford County, Connecticut, vaccination rate 98.4%. New London, 97.2%. Tallinn County, 97.8% for measles. So we are well into the safe zone here. Why? Because you can't just get an exemption for a frivolous reason. Make up your own religion, personal choice. That's not a personal choice. We need to protect all children in this state. So for Connecticut, you need to have a health reason that's documented. And we have joined other like-minded states in doing so. So we're going to keep an eye on that. But the next thing is COVID, right? Because we're concerned about that. So they met, this is hours ago, they met last night to talk about whether they're going to recommend vaccination for high-risk populations by seniors, who they're going to recommend it for. We originally thought it was going to be pregnant moms. We thought it was going to be young children. And then we thought it was going to be seniors. They said nothing. I mean zero. They have absolutely no recommendation regarding COVID. So instead, they've decided people can make individual decisions after talking with a doctor, nurse, or pharmacist. Holy mackerel. We went through all of this just to say the same advice you've been getting on Healthy Rounds. Talk to your doctor. Talk to your pediatrician. These are the people you pay. Talk to them. Get their advice, not the internet, not the ACIP. Okay, so right now, here we are with a lack of recommendation. Okay, that means anyone can get this vaccine and they're not going to be charged for it, and the insurance companies are going to have to follow it. The bad part of this is no one has really encouraged people to get it if you're in a high-risk group like myself being over 65. So with that, we're going to keep an eye on this as we move through this season, and we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Corey Edgar. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. It gives me great pleasure to have as my guest today, Dr. Corey Edgar. Dr. Edgar is Associate Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Connecticut. He's also the co-director for the Institute for Sports Medicine here at the University of Connecticut. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tony. Dr. Lessie, it's a pleasure to be here with you again.
Today I want to talk a little bit about throwing injuries. You know, a lot of our listeners have children and grandchildren who are getting into throwing sports, whether they be a quarterback, a pitcher, baseball player in general. And I know you see a fair number of these upper extremity injuries. I know one of your areas of expertise is so-called Tommy John surgery, although it may be misnamed after the patient. But nevertheless, let's talk a little bit about some of the patients you see, what youth players should be doing and shouldn't be doing. What's the most common thing you see in little leaguers and young athletes as far as upper extremity injuries?
Yeah, so huge topic. Obviously, we could spend 3 hours on this topic, and it's also a topic I'm very passionate about, not only because I'm a physician that sees these, but I also have a 11-year-old baseball player, so it hits home. So I think the biggest thing for me is prevention. Obviously, that's the key. I mean, it's one thing to talk about when they come in the office and prevention is passed and now we're dealing with enough injury that necessitates a potential surgery. So in the beginning, let's just focus on how do we prevent these kids. So the old conundrum is how much usage. And Jimmy Andrews, back when he was president of our society, started a pitch count, which was fantastic and has really helped a lot. And so Little League participates with this. But as you know, we have transitioned into youth sports like travel baseball, and they don't necessarily participate with usage limitation, i.e. pitch counts for pitchers. And those also don't apply to certain other position players that are of high volume, like a catcher. And so we have to temper the amount of throwing that occurs, not only in a game situation, but also prelude to that, practice and so forth. Then there's the whole idea of sports specialization. And so in New England, we're kind of forced to have sports specialization because in the winter months, it's impossible to play baseball unless you play inside. And so we've gotten to a stage where kids transition from baseball or throwing sports like football to basketball and other great sports. The problem is they've completely shut down their arm. And now we re-ramp up after 3 months. And then now we have a short burst of overstimulation to an elbow that's still growing in development, and potentially a kid that's now put on 20 pounds over the winter and had a growth spurt. So I think those are some of the big nuances to the little leaguer or say 10 to 14 year old throwing elbow that are different than that high school athlete that's more mature but now dealing with elbow pain and we're worried about medial elbow insufficiency.
So let me go back a little bit and get into when young people learning to pitch. I remember having Billy Connors on as my guest years ago, and I asked him, what should parents be doing with their children if they want to pitch? Billy Connors being kind of internationally known pitching coach for the New York Yankees and specializing in rehab. And he said he advises parents to just have their child throw strikes. Just throw strikes. Don't worry about a cutter, don't worry about a curveball, just get it over the plate and you'd avoid a lot of injury. Is that still the case? Do you find that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's, you know, he's pulling a little fun, but it's a great point because at the end of the day, when you walk a kid, guess what? That's 5 to 6 pitches, and now you have to restart it again. So throwing strikes is critical, right? Assuming the defense makes some plays, you want to get out of there with as least amount of stress across the elbow as possible. Do I think a secondary point is there clear data that says a certain type of pitch puts the elbow at risk more than others?
Exactly.
The answer is we don't know. Ironically, we used to say curveballs in particular, it's probably less about the throwing of the curveball and more about how they change their arm angles and they have to throw it in a different way. But if you're throwing it the same way, it's probably not as much stress, but it's more important to throw the strikes. The only, ironically, the one pitch that is a very useful pitch in the high school athlete, the changeup, is a little bit more stressful to the elbow and probably ill-advised for somebody that's still skeletally maturing is to try to develop the changeup. That should be a later in the career process. Now, sliders is another thing. If you throw a slider like the major leaguers, you're really stressing the elbow and you're really ripping through that ball. But you can easily, the kids, and if they have a good pitching coach and a good coach that's involved, and there's a lot of stuff on YouTube, plus and minus, that just by changing your finger position and letting it slide out of your hand versus elevating out of your hand, you can get some movement on the ball, and it's probably relatively safe.
At what age should young people begin to start throwing, you know, more curveballs, change-ups, things like that? You said wait for a more mature elbow. At what age do you think the elbow matures?
Well, by definition of maturity, we're kind of referring to when the growth plate. So if we get x-rays of a 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old, what we're going to see is these lines that by the inexperienced would people would be worried about a fracture, when actually these are the growth plates, the epiphyses, places where the calcified bone are formed, you know, via this growth plate where the cartilage is growing. Now, that's an area of weak, or it's a space of less, that stress can be tolerated a little less. And so that's where we see this, and that's the quote-unquote immature elbows when they have these growth plates. Little leaguer's elbow, by definition, is pain along the medial elbow, but that is a spectrum of injury to the growth plate, with the worst being it pops off and has to be surgically repaired to the low end of just apophysitis, just like you would have with Osgood Schlatter. And so those are the injuries that we worry about in these little leaguers. And it doesn't come mature until their growth is mature. So back to your original question, when to throw those. Again, we see in the Little League World Series, these 11 and 12-year-olds are ripping off curveballs left and right. Now, granted, the injury rates are increasing a little bit, but it's not necessarily because they're throwing that certain pitch. It's got much more to do with the volume of pitches that they're throwing.
Let's talk a little bit about what is Tommy John surgery, you know, and really how has that evolved? I mean, there are so many different variations now. I think most of us all know that it's a damage to the elbow, it gets repaired, and whoever it is out for a year. But what is it exactly?
Yeah, so as we see, it's become extremely popular. People are bouncing back from Tommy John surgery better than they ever have been, to the point where people are increasing velocity. But really what it is the medial or the inside of your elbow. There is a capsule and a thickening in the capsule that we refer to as the ulnar collateral ligament. It's on the medial side of the elbow. And that is what protects the elbow from a gapping or an opening. Because when you throw the ball, there's a stress that wants to open the medial side of your elbow when you accelerate and throw that ball. And so when that becomes attenuated or ruptured, and now there's laxity in that, that's when the athlete starts to experience pain, starts to experience potentially numbness if the nerve's also involved, which it commonly is. And then they lose not only velocity, they lose location, they have pain that lasts past the pitching. And so when that is can't get improved with rehab, then we start talking about surgery. There's other things that we can do, which I know we're going to get to later, but from a surgical standpoint, there's variations. There's repair of this, there's reconstruction, which means we take tissue from elsewhere in the body or from a cadaver and we augment that capsule and we make it thicker. That's really the Tommy John surgery. There's a couple of variations on how to do it, but all in all, it addresses the same process of repairing and enhancing the tissue that's there to give them more structure so they can go back to throwing a baseball.
So one of the things, some people have believed that because athletes come back and they're throwing harder after Tommy John surgery, some people believe that it's a performance enhancing surgery. I've maintained, and maybe I'm wrong, it's that they finally paid attention to doing their arm exercises because they've been out. So suddenly they're doing their arm program a little bit more faithfully than they were before the surgery. Am I wrong? Is there any truth to people thinking, yeah, I'm going to get my kid Tommy John surgery so he could throw harder?
There is definitely truth that people come in inquiring about that, thinking that it's a surgery that's going to be from a 1980s movie, Rookie of the Year, where the kid gets injured and now all of a sudden throws 180. So not the case. And I think you're incredibly correct in that they've struggled with injury, and now they're recovering from Tommy John, and that process is 6 months to a year to return. And during that process, it's not about the healing. It's about what you just mentioned. It's about refocusing on muscle masses and accelerators and decelerators that they probably haven't paid attention to, and taking that whole process to rebuild up their body that then once they get back to that high level of pinching equates to better performance, whether it's velocity performance, whether it's spin rate performance, or whether it's localization of pitch performance. And people see the snapshot of before and after and forget about all the stuff in between.
Absolutely. Okay, I'm glad we got that cleared up. The next topic I really wanted to go on to was the use of biologics in orthopedic surgery. Now, we hear the term stem cells. That's like the buzzword. If you get stem cells, it fixes everything. And we are going to have a further discussion on in the future about neurologic diseases and people saying they can cure Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and MS with stem cells. But there's always been a role for biologics. Let's use the general term of biologics in orthopedics. And I know that's a specific area of your research, especially with generating new cartilage and things such as that. So can you talk and give us kind of a general discussion of what these biologics are and how they apply to orthopedic surgery?
So great question. Again, something we could probably talk about for 3 hours. So biologics just refers to robbing Peter to pay Paul within your body. So we're taking something that has the potential to heal. When we look at it in its very basic sense or in a culture dish as we study it, and we're applying it to a condition in our body that's now injured or inflamed, and we're trying to get it to heal. Really, the most common things that are within that bucket or that term are platelet-rich plasma, bone marrow aspirate, basically concentrations of the peripheral blood or adipose tissue. And then there's some injectables that are not really from the body, but basically, you know, synthetics. But all of those are material that theoretically enhances a biologic response. Now, the stem cells, I think, is a very important thing to talk to, and that is and is not a misnomer. So the FDA has clearly said that we are no longer allowed to say stem cells, meaning in advertisements, people used to say stem cells. You can't actually say that anymore because what they are harvesting is usually blood or a reservoir of hematopoietic cells that are from iliac crest or places where there are higher percentages of hematopoietic stem cells. Now, the only true stem cell, meaning by definition, a cell that can differentiate, meaning turn into any type of cell in our body, only happens in the placenta. So that tissue is also being used. But
so is that
whole,
umbilical? So in
correct,
other words,
correct.
When a child is born now, some people bank their
correct.
Umbilical blood.
Correct.
Right?
And that is something that has true, different. Like you could differentiate those cells in anything. Now, we don't have the real power to control it, which is different than just injecting it and assuming that the body is going to facilitate the healing process. And there's also some ethical, some storage. That's a whole other debate. So, but in terms of peripheral blood or peripheral hematopoietic reservoirs, iliac crest or whatever the case may be, we harvest that tissue, and it's really a liquid tissue. It's a, you know, basically blood.
So you do a bone marrow
aspirate. We spin it down and we concentrate it, with the premise being that in the original aspirate, that's 60 cc's, 120 cc's, we bring it down to 2 or 3 cc's, we have times X concentrated whatever stem cells might have been in there. Now, those stem cells that are there are now slightly differentiated. They're called hematopoietic stem cells, and they are, or mesenchymal stem cells, I apologize, and they are ones that can differentiate into cartilage, into bone, into fat, into muscle, and into, cartilage, bone, fat, muscle, and tendon. And so, but how to control that is another different thing. So the premise is we can inject it to a site of injury and your body's going to tell it what to do. Well, you need a scaffold, meaning a way to get it to stay there. So whether it heals to the local tissue or not remains to be seen. You need to stimulate it in the correct pathway with either morphogens or other type of growth hormones that are in that local environment. So right now, typically people, like there's a really popular. We talked about this. There's a really popular places that are advertising this. That's no surgery, and basically what they're trying to do is inject these substances into joints or tendons that are inflamed, and you can get a response. Now, there's some data that suggests that it might help. It doesn't heal. It might alleviate some of the symptoms, i.e. pain. And it basically does that by extrapolating the inflammatory process, facilitating more scar formation, and then taking the stress off it. So in theory, whatever ailment you have is now less painful. Is it going to cure arthritis? No. Is it going to regrow cartilage? No. Is the same pathology going to be there? Yes. Potentially, you're able to tolerate it more.
So when you go to one of these places, they do a bone marrow aspirate? Because that's not a painful procedure.
It can be, yes. So reservoirs are typically bone marrow. You can take it from fat, and you can take it from systemic blood.
And still get the same cells?
No, you can't, but those are the places that they're going to get it from. So if you take it from fat, you can still get some mesenchymal stem cells. The highest reservoir comes from the iliac crest or the bone marrow, and you can get basically platelet-rich plasma or very, very, very potentially weak concentrate of these mesenchymal stem cells from the peripheral blood.
All right, let's talk about platelet-rich plasma, PRP, because it's something that we more commonly use.
Correct.
Right? Yep. We use it here at UConn in the clinic all the time.
Yep.
So does it work? I mean, does it regenerate anything? I know you said, so it does not.
Does not regenerate anything, no.
Okay, so we're talking about pain control.
Does it heal? Inflammation reduction.
Yeah. So what are you actually injecting? Are you injecting cells that are serving as the, is it pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory?
Yes.
Both?
Both.
Okay.
Potentially. And they're not cells. So platelet-rich plasma. So we're actually spinning out the cells. And one of the debates is there are white cell-rich and white cell-poor. So leukocyte-rich, leukocyte-poor. But basically white cell-rich, white cell-poor. And we're using the platelets. Platelets are, to explain it simply, are little vesicles or little bags of some growth factors that are floating around in our plasma, which is the liquid part of our blood that supports the cells. And so you can use those, and in a culture dish, you can get those to stimulate cells to do different things, lay more cartilage down, differentiate more. But a culture dish and a human body are like apples and oranges, to keep it simple, but very different environments. The only place that's really been shown to be more effective than placebo or corticosteroid injections is tendinopathies around the elbow, meaning, you know, golfer's elbow or tennis elbow, a little bit about the quadriceps and patella tendon, and maybe a little bit above normal within the knee joints for arthritis only.
Okay, let's move on. One of the things I always like about our show is we ask about what's the latest thing. Now, I know you have a very active research laboratory, so you know, we're expecting a big time response here. The biggest time response was from our associate, Dr. Cato Lorenzen, who many years ago actually had me speechless. Maybe the only time I've been speechless on the show, when he said, well, in his lab, they're getting ready to regrow limbs in regenerative medicine, which we know is a clear passion of his and a frontier. What are you doing in your lab, and what is it our listeners need to know about what's coming in the future?
So I think for me, it's around the cartilage, specifically cartilage in the knee. So outside of the elbow conditions, the other thing that I kind of have a niche and a passion for is injuries to the kneecap or one area of the knee, so underneath the kneecap or the patellofemoral joint. When younger people have recurrent patella injuries, the cartilage becomes diseased. You get potholes in the road, so to speak, and we don't have a great way to resurface those, and they don't do well in this environment. So we've tried resurfacing with cartilage that we grow. We've tried taking cadaveric tissue and putting it in there, resurfacing the pothole. On smaller lesions, we take it from Rob Peter to pay Paul, we take it from one place to the knee and put it in there. All of them do well for a very short period of time. It is not a home run. They are not successful. Part of the reason is we believe that it's not just the cartilage, it's the bone. And all of our research right now is working on how to enhance the bone healing process that supports the cartilage. So once we can do that in ways similar to Dr. Lorenzen, who I do work with, in terms of elution potential material that can kind of effectively do this. We have to remember these things are in stages, so we have to limit the scar formation so there's porosity so that vessels can now have pathways to regrow. If we get too much of a robust scar formation, it heals, but it doesn't continue to heal because there's no ability for blood flow to access the quote-unquote bone that needs to be resorbed. So this is my area of passion. We've developed an animal model. We're looking at people that have failed, and we're looking at their tissue when they get converted from naive to having the transplant to now unfortunately getting converted to a partial knee replacement. And we can look at that tissue and see what has happened over the 5 years that they've had a graft.
So are we talking about potentially patients with arthritis, or are we talking about fracture? Who are the patients who would benefit from this?
Yeah, so the patient population is anywhere from 13, 14, 15-year-olds that are having new-onset patellofemoral disease that knock off a piece of cartilage that we can't get it to heal, to that next generation of 15, 16 to 25-year-olds that have had chronic patella instability or maltracking that now have a wear and tear lesion that's, I would call, pre-arthritis. So when most people think of arthritis, it's like global disease. This is more focal in nature. And then that 20 to 30-year-old that's really too young to get a knee replacement or to do a patellofemoral replacement, but they have pain. And so pain is secondary to the cartilage loss. And even though it's not global, meaning the whole joint is not affected, it's focal. And it's these focal lesions that we don't have a great solution for a long-term or definitive care. So that's what I'm talking about, is those people that are really young, that have focal lesions, or people that have a chronic process that have developed a focal lesion but are still a very young person.
So essentially, this is addressing, we see older athletes in our clinic here.
Yes.
And they all come in with knee replacements, right?
Right.
From playing football, basketball, whatever. So it sounds like your approach would hopefully avoid that in the long run by treating them when they're younger.
Correct. Yeah, obviously, nothing's perfect, but those athletes that have developed their wear and tear, once it's pain and that process of arthritis, meaning cartilage loss, bone inflammation, joint inflammation, once you start that, it's a really hard thing to overcome, hence all the injections that we talked about earlier. So if we can get to that much earlier when it's a focal lesion, I think, and a lot of people think that are in this area, that we have a much better chance of stopping the progression down the road.
Thank you, Corey. Thank you very much for your time today. Many thanks to my guest, Dr. Corey Edgar. As always, many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board, and Joey Burgoyne, who's put this together. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we're going to be talking about hormone replacement with Dr. Pamela Zazamia. And we're taking a little different aspect of this. Really, we're talking about the pituitary gland. We're talking about testosterone replacement as we get older and things such as that. She is a board-certified endocrinologist who has spent time on our program before. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast by going to Apple or Odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.